Portugal was the first European nation to exploit the sea for spices and the global empire that went along with them. The quest began as early as 1419 when Prince Henry and his English wife, Philippa, established his court at Sagres, a stark outcropping of rock at the southernmost edge of Portugal. Known as Prince Henry the Navigator, he rarely went to sea himself. Instead, he inspired others to conquer the ocean. Portuguese ships faced obstacles so overwhelming, so shrouded in ignorance and superstition, that only extraordinarily confident and accomplished mariners dared to venture into the open sea, as the Atlantic Ocean was then known. When Prince Henry came to Sagres, Europeans knew little about the ocean beyond latitude 27 degrees north, marked by Cape Bojador in West Africa. It was believed that the waters south of this point teemed with monsters, that their storms made them too violent to navigate, and that inescapable fogs would envelop wayward ships. In the face of all these dangers, Prince Henry offered a bold reply: "You cannot find a peril so great that the hope of reward will not be greater." He attracted navigators, shipwrights, astronomers, pilots, cosmographers, and cartographers, both Christians and Jews, to the Academy at Sagres, where they cooperated in the enterprise of exploring the world under Henry's direction. The ocean proved extremely hazardous. Prince Henry sent no less than 14 expeditions to Cape Bojador within 12 years, and they all failed. He convinced Gil Eanes, a Portuguese explorer, to try once more. And in 1434, Eanes finally accomplished what so many had said was impossible. He sailed safely past Cape Bojador. The following year, Eanes, together with Alfonso Gonzalves Baldaia, returned to Cape Bojador. Baldaia sailed further south and collected thousands of sealskins. This was the first commercial cargo brought back to Europe from that part of Africa. On subsequent voyages, Portuguese ships brought gold, animal hides, elephant tusks, and slaves. Every captain sponsored by Prince Henry was under orders to record the tides, the currents, and the winds, and to compile accurate charts of the coastlines. Voyage by voyage, these charts added to the Portuguese knowledge of the oceans and the world beyond the Iberian Peninsula. Portugal retained its ambition to wrest control of the Spice Islands trade from the Arabs into the 16th century, hoping to reach the Spice Islands. In pursuit of this goal, daring, even reckless mariners presented themselves to the king to seek backing for their journeys of exploration to these exotic and dangerous new worlds. Most met with frustration, for the Portuguese court was a place of intrigue, suspicion, double-dealing, and envy. Among the most persistent supplicants was a minor nobleman with a long and checkered history in the service of the Portuguese Empire in Africa, Fernão de Magalhães, or Ferdinand Magellan. According to most accounts, he was born in 1480 in the remote mountain parish of Sabrosa, the seat of the family homestead. He spent his childhood in northwestern Portugal, within sight of the pounding surf of the Atlantic. His father, Rodrigo de Magalhães, traced his lineage back to an 11th century French crusader who distinguished himself sufficiently to be rewarded with a grant of land from the Duke of Burgundy. Rodrigo himself qualified as minor Portuguese nobility and served as a sheriff of the port of Aveiro. Even these basic outlines about Magellan's ancestry are in doubt. In 1567, his heirs began squabbling over his estate, and questions arose over his exact place in the Magalhães family tree. The difficulties in tracing Magellan's ancestry arise from the idiosyncrasies of Portuguese genealogy. For example, until the 18th century, males usually assumed their father's last name, but the females often chose other surnames for themselves, and some children assumed a grandfather's name or still other family names. Ferdinand Magellan's brother Diogo took on the name de Sousa from his paternal grandmother's family. At 12 years of age, Ferdinand Magellan and his brother Diogo moved to Lisbon, where they became pages at the royal court. There, Ferdinand took advantage of the most advanced education in Portugal. Through his privileged position at court, Ferdinand came of age hearing about Portuguese and Spanish discoveries in the Indies, and he was privy to the secrets of the Portuguese exploration of the ocean. He even assisted with preparing fleets leaving for India, familiarizing himself with provisions, rigging, and arms. Magellan seemed destined to become a captain himself, but in 1495, his patron, King João, the leader of a faction with only tenuous claims to the throne, suddenly died. João's successor, Manuel I, mistrusted young Magellan, who had, after all, been allied with the opposition. As a result, the fast-rising courtier found his career stymied. Finally, in 1505, after a decade of anonymous service at the palace, Ferdinand and Diogo received dual assignments aboard a mammoth fleet consisting of 22 ships bound for India, all of them under the control of Francisco de Almeida. Ferdinand Magellan spent the next 8 years trying to establish a permanent Portuguese presence in India, dashing from one trading post to another and from one battle to the next. He survived multiple wounds and, if nothing else, learned to stay alive in a hostile environment. In this, the first phase of his career abroad, Magellan had displayed remarkable bravery and toughness, but in the end, his foreign service proved a mixed adventure. He invested most of his fortune with a merchant who soon died. In the ensuing confusion, Magellan lost most of his assets. He petitioned King Manuel for restitution, but the king refused the request. Returning to Lisbon, Magellan, still bristling with ambition, commenced a new phase in his career. Seeking to make himself useful to the crown, he involved himself with the Portuguese struggle to dominate North Africa. In 1513, he found an ideal opportunity to demonstrate his loyalty and usefulness to the crown when the city of Azamor, in Morocco, suddenly refused to pay its annual tribute to Portugal. The Moroccan governor, Muli Zayam, ringed the city with a powerful, well-equipped army. King Manuel responded to the challenge by sending the largest seaborne force ever to sail for his kingdom, 500 ships, 15,000 soldiers, the entire military might of this small nation. Among the hordes of soldiers sent to defend the honor of Portugal was Ferdinand Magellan, along with an aging steed, the only mount he could afford. He rode courageously into battle, only to lose his horse to the Arabs. Portugal reclaimed the city, but Magellan was indignant. He had lost his horse in the service of his country and king, and the Portuguese army was offering him only a fraction of what he considered to be his mount's true value as compensation. Displaying a hot-headedness and tactlessness that bedeviled his entire career, Magellan wrote directly to King Manuel. Manuel proved no more generous than he had been on the occasion of Magellan's previous demand for compensation. The new request was swiftly dismissed. Magellan's reaction was telling. He stubbornly remained at his post, somehow acquired a new horse, and participated in skirmishes with the Arabs who swooped out of the desert wastes to harass Portuguese soldiers guarding Azamor. Magellan showed himself to be a fearless warrior, engaging in hand-to-hand combat with the enemy on a daily basis. In one confrontation, he received a serious wound from an Arab lance, which left him with a shattered knee and a lifelong limp. It also ended his career as a soldier. At last, he received a taste of the recognition he craved when his service in battle and war wounds earned him a promotion to the rank of quartermaster. The position entitled him to a share of the spoils of war, which proved to be his undoing. In a subsequent battle, Arabs surrendered an immense herd of livestock, over 200,000 goats, camels, and horses. Magellan was among the officers responsible for distributing the spoils in an equitable fashion, and he decided to pay off tribal allies with some of the captured animals. As a result of this transaction, Magellan and another officer were indicted for selling 400 goats to the enemy and keeping the proceeds for personal gain. The charges were preposterous. Magellan failed to respond and, without authorization, left Morocco for Lisbon, where he appeared before King Manuel. Magellan did not apologize for his conduct in Morocco, but demanded an increase in the allowance he received as a member of the royal household, his moradia. Making a bad situation even worse, he lectured the king, reminding him that he, Ferdinand Magellan, was a nobleman and had rendered lifelong service to the crown and had the wounds to show for it. Nothing but a more generous moradia would suffice to acknowledge his stature, his sense of honor, and his idealism. Jealous rivals whispered behind Magellan's back that his limp was merely an act designed to elicit sympathy. King Manuel's judgment, when it came, was swift and sure. The insolent and foolish Magellan was to return to Morocco immediately to face charges for treason, corruption, and leaving the army without authorization. This he did. After investigating the evidence, a tribunal in Morocco dismissed all charges against him, and he returned to Lisbon, clutching a letter of recommendation from his commanding officer. Displaying superhuman stubbornness, Magellan went back to his sovereign king to demand the increased moradia with more vehemence than ever. Once more, the king refused. Magellan was entering middle age, with a bad leg and an unfairly tarnished reputation. Short and dark, and teetering on the brink of poverty, he looked nothing like the aristocrat he thought himself to be. And he still yearned to distinguish himself in the service of Portugal, to make a name for himself that would rank with the important figures of the day who opened new trade routes for Portugal in the Indies, and in the process became rich themselves. It seemed that Magellan was merely compounding his folly by asking the king to back an entire expedition, but the would-be explorer saw matters differently. He was offering the king a scheme to fill the royal coffers with the wealth of the Indies. Acknowledging that he needed help to persuade King Manuel, Magellan brought a prominent personage with him, Ruy Falero, a mathematician, astronomer, and nautical scholar. He was, in short, that quintessential Renaissance man, a cosmologist. Falero was a brilliant but unstable man who impressed his colleagues with his demonic personality. Despite the impressive credentials he brought to the venture, Ruy Falero had his own troubled history with King Manuel. The king had refused Falero's application to become a judiciary astronomer, and worse, had appointed a rival to a new chair in astronomy at the University of Coimbra. So when Magellan and Falero presented themselves at court with their plan, the king was already prejudiced against both men. Three times, Magellan asked for royal authorization for a voyage to the Indies to discover a water route to the fabled but little-known Spice Islands. Three times, the king, who had disliked and mistrusted Magellan for more than 20 years, refused. Finally, in September of 1517, Magellan asked if he could offer his services elsewhere, and to his astonishment, the king replied that Magellan was free to do as he pleased. And when Magellan knelt to kiss the king's hands, as custom dictated, King Manuel concealed them behind his cloak and turned his back on his petitioner. The humiliating rejection proved to be the making of Ferdinand Magellan. After he received the final rebuff from the Portuguese king, he suddenly found direction in his life, and he moved quickly, carried along by his own ambitions and by the tides of history.